everything that happened. I think everything was done to the highest level of professionalism, and we had very excellent participation, I think, in almost every event. That was one event that I was disappointed that more faculty didn't show up for, but that's the nature of the academy. But in general, it was an very exciting week, and one that I told several groups this week, at the end of the day, it wasn't so much about my inauguration on Saturday. The whole thing was designed as a mechanism for us to step back in a very public, highly visible way, reflect on the excellence of the university that has acquired over since 1844 and more recently, but also to have an opportunity to put a few stakes in the ground regarding the vision for this great university and where it must go if, in fact, we're going to remain a viable academic research university, driving the education of our students and innovation that's necessary for the vitality of the state, the region, and the nation. And so I think we achieved a pretty good outcome from all of that. And so so I was very, very pleased. And again, thank you for your support since over the last 9.5 months or so. You know, be a year before I know it. Time flies when you're having fun.
And you're still in that hunt.
I'm sorry. That honeymoon lasted about 2 weeks. So it was the shortest honeymoon on record. But let me just say, it really has been wonderful. And I do think the week-long celebration was successful. And I was deeply moved by the participation of the Tutu sisters, and deeply moved by Desmond Tutu taking the time out to record a video. He's funny.
He
has a great sense of humor, if you call it. He got a great kick out of saying that line about you telling him that I wasn't interested in being an administrative, but God had other plans. And I kept laughing. I thought that's typical Tutu. So I was very pleased with that. And as I said, I think all of the events were done at a very high level. And we were pleased to participate, but we're also pleased that it's over and now we can be about implementing the plan. So it's time to get down to work. Just to talk a little bit about the four stakes that we put in the ground, we were very, very thoughtful about choosing those four things that we wanted to focus on. And we're the first to admit that it's not a comprehensive list. It does not embody everything that we know we must do to advance this university, but from those four stakes, I kind of think of them as hubs, if you will, that from that we can touch all of the areas that we've identified through a visioning process that we started here about 3 or 4 months ago with the senior leadership team. As well, from those four stakes, it will connect back to the strategic planning process that was launched under George Phillips' leadership, which is the more comprehensive strategy that lays out the path and the path and the vision for where we must move to as an institution. So we're very, very excited about that, and clearly the need to expand our degree portfolio is absolutely critical. We must recruit more non-resident, out-of-state students from other parts of the U.S. We are really at the bottom of the pack as it relates to international students. Binghamton does a much better job than the other university centers, and so does Buffalo and Stony Brook. And because of that, there are financial implications for this as well. And I'm going to say this to you, I'm very concerned because I see, and I know we're recording this for the minutes, but I also think we can maybe modify some of the things I say, can I?
Yes.
I'm not being critical, but I didn't come here for this university to be number four among university centers. I aspire for us to be number one. Okay, I want to be very clear about that. But if you look at what's been happening at Binghamton over the years in terms of how they are growing their research portfolio, we have a tendency to think about them in terms of being a great place for undergraduates. Well, they're that and they're more. They're starting to develop a very strong research profile, and they really have been aggressive about bringing in students from across the world. And therefore, when you look at their overall financial picture, and Vince will tell you this, they have more flexible resources actually than we do, because they have the additional resource above and beyond the state tuition that we collect for having 88% of our students come from the state, and them with about 24%, I think, in terms of non-resident and students. It gives them greater financial flexibility. And so this is in addition to the educational benefit. This whole international strategy is a key component of an alternative revenue stream to generate the resources that's going to be necessary for us to finance the mission, these four stakes that we're putting in the ground. And it's going to definitely add to the student experience. But so there are financial reasons for doing this as well. And one of the other reasons that I casually mentioned is the fact that the demographics are going in the wrong direction for us to sustain a model where 90% of our students come from the state of New York. It's just not going to be sustainable in 10, 15, 20 years from now. It's just not going to work. And so we have to think about a different approach. And we're serious about expanding our role in community engagement and serious about growing our resources to fulfill the mission, both in terms of our sponsored research dollars that we bring in, as in terms of increasing our endowments from about $400 million to $100 million in the next 5 years. So we are thinking about ways that we will be operationalizing and keeping close and creating a team that's going to be working specifically around those four stakes to make sure that we're thinking about this and working each and every day to drive those stakes to fruition. So I just want, we'd be talking to you more about that perhaps at a later date, but I just wanted to let you know that that wasn't just fodder for an inaugural speech. We're very serious about this. This is the framework around which we plan to advance this university, so we're very excited about it. And we are very, very excited about the fact that my understanding, in part because of all the celebration and reflection about the university over the celebrating the advance week. This week, we were very excited to receive a commitment for one of the largest gifts in the history of the university, $1.5 million, from Spencer and Pat Standish, committed to a named professorship, endowed professorship at the University School of Business. This will be in the area of entrepreneurship and will really help advance our business school to that other stake that I put in the ground about being within the top 50 in the next 5 years. This will go a long way to advancing that work. And what I like about this endowed professorship in entrepreneurship is that we leverage three tenure track positions in entrepreneurship that will not only be just from the business aspect in the business school, which we know they already have great leadership there in terms of entrepreneurship, but it also will provide positions in entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurship, and also in the life sciences. And I think that reflects the innovation that is coming out of our school of business, and we're very excited about that as well. And I know you all know about the our new $24 million sports complex. We had our first opening game, which was extremely blown away by 11,000 people. First time in the history of this university, you could just feel the energy in the air, people tailgating, and it was just really, I think, one of the most positive community, campus community building events that has occurred around here in a very long time. And even though it came up a bit short, you know, as they say, it was deja vu almost all over again 2 weeks in a row in terms of having a tied score and then not bringing home the win, which was painful, but we're very, very proud of our student athletes, and know that, you know, they're a number. They're playing at a very competitive athletic conference, and so we didn't expect them to, you know, to be undefeated. And they'll continually and systematically get better. And now we have a facility, I think, that reflects the quality of our athletic program. So we're very pleased with all of you that have been involved with that. And if you haven't been to a game, we encourage you to come soon. There's something called homecoming that's coming up, and we certainly expect all of you there. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later. As you know, Coach Ford is leaving. And so in order to make sure we don't lose any momentum with the next recruitment season, we have Vice President McElroy and myself have started a search committee that we hope will identify a post to be in place by December 1st to replace those boards. So keep your eyes attuned to that. We're very excited about finding someone that can come in and continue to move that that program forward. You know, Coach Ford leaves tremendously big shoes to fill, but we certainly think that given the reputation of our program, we should have around the country high quality coaches that would be interested in that position. The Startup New York work, as you know, we're still waiting on the exact rules and regulations to be propagated and finished, but we are making some progress in that regard, and we will be keeping you informed about the progress as that goes along. We're already thinking about our strategy, have some potential partners that we're trying to close deals with over the next several months, because we decided that we really couldn't wait until the rules and regulations are finished before we start to cultivate some of these potential partners for startup. And I think at the appropriate time, you're going to be excited about some of the ideas and some potentials that we can develop on that work. Just to give you a quick update as well on CNSE, the Chancellor, Elaine Calheiros, and Jim Alatras, and Stacey Ashterman, and myself met about a week and a half ago to lay out the initial framework around the process for moving that implementation team and whole process forward. And so I think that team will be meeting soon. We did make the decision that in addition to that implementation team, we thought it was important that we have an opportunity for faculty and staff from the University Senate, UUP, and others, and students to be involved in some way with that whole process. So we formed our own campus advisory committee, and this grew out of a conversation with the leadership at the University Senate, as well as with the people from the faculty union, particularly Brett Benjamin. And we've asked Jim Acker, who's a distinguished professor and college professor in the School of Social Justice, to serve as the chair of that group. And we hope that they will be having their first meeting in the near future, probably shortly after we have the first meeting of the implementation team, so that we can keep everything aligned. And so that is going to be underway. One of the things I've asked for clarification on is what is going to be the academic and the business model for this new structure of CNSE, because that's going to tell us a lot about what our MOU should look like between NATO and between the University of Oregon. So we don't want to spend a lot of time working on the wrong assumptions. And so once we have that clarification, it'll give us a greater sense of whether we're talking about continuing to provide all the services we now provide, or if it's going to be a subset of that. And I'm sure that that clarification, if it's not put on the table before we have the first meeting, it, I guarantee you I will put it on the table at the first meeting, because it's important for us to understand. Just a few congratulations here. Peter Bloniars, who's the Dean of the College of Computer and Information Sciences, was named as Executive Director and Senior Policy Advisor to the Governor on his Cybersecurity Advisory Board. So Peter effectively stepped down as the Dean on an interim temporary basis to assume this responsibility. And so we're very, very excited about this. Peter, as you know, has a lot of knowledge and expertise in this area. And I think he will represent the University at Albany and represent the state very well in this important new security advisory board. And Sue Fairman, who has worked as vice provost, will be stepping in on an interim basis to fill in Peter's role. Teresa Pardoe, the director of the Center of Technology and Government, was appointed a policy advisor for the New York's Open Data Initiative. So congratulations to Teresa. And Sue Phillips, just a few weeks ago, I saw her and she said, well, I got to get busy on something. I said, well, what's going on? She was asked to testify and did testify before Congress to offer expert testimony that is related to the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. So we should congratulate Sue on representing the University of Albany extremely well. And I haven't had a chance to read the text of her testimony, but I planned on doing so. So congratulations to all three of these university leaders for their accomplishments in representing the university well. We had our first royal visit last week. Wasn't that last week?
Nope, this week.
That was this week? Boy, time really flies. That was this week. His Royal Majesty Benjamin Akinchukwu of the Kingdom of Agbor, which is in the southern part of Nigeria. I guess there are several monarchs in that part of the country, and he's one of them. And he came to visit us on his first trip to the U.S. And we had an opportunity to provide a tour of the campus for him. We also arranged for a couple of our Nigerian students to be part of the meeting with him. He was he became king when he was 28 months old.
Whoa.
Literally, he ruled the crib. And very delightful. I think everyone that's a part of my team, a very delightful young man. He has to be, what, in his early 30s, maybe?
Yeah.
Early to mid-30s. Very thoughtful, very engaging, educated in England. Just a very thoughtful man, and he's very interested. He's also the chancellor of a very large private university in his kingdom as well. And he called up the vice chancellor, who is essentially the president. This guy had to be in bed that time of night. And we had a brief conversation. He's very interested in collaborating with the university at Albany. So that was our first royal visit. But he was absolutely delightful. We weren't sure what to expect, but it was a lot of fun having an opportunity to meet with him, and he seems to be deeply interested in collaboration.
People
that show up.
Out of the blue.
You never know what show king's up. Gonna knock.
Except the name, I thought it was like a made up
kingdom. No, Agbor, don't look at the map.
They were driving by
550,000 people.
That's
in this kingdom.
Big.
Yeah. That's a good size kingdom, Good size kingdom. I'm not gonna say what you thought I was gonna say. I'd also like to take a moment, and I'm pretty much done here. I know this is taking too long, but I'd like to commend our university police department. As you probably heard, there were two attempted abductions on campus, same location, within minutes, half hour of each other, I think, and both students are fine. One was able to kind of fight the guy off, and in the other case, a student intervened. And the student was able to get away. And the suspect, that thanks to videotape, was apprehended. And initially, the victims did not come forward, so he could only be charged with a misdemeanor. But then when we did a press release, the media got involved, the victim did come forward the next morning, and so now he's being held without bail. And will be charged and hopefully prosecuted accordingly. And so I just want to commend our University Police Department for working very effectively with the Albany Police Department to review the videotape that led to the arrest. And so it was a very fine piece of police work, so congratulations. As I said, homecoming is coming on the 18th. We've got a suite of activities occurring. I really encourage you to participate. And lastly, Citizen Laureate in October 24th. This year, the academic laureate is Stephen Beck, who's a Holocaust scholar and a Union College professor. So we're very pleased to identify and acknowledge his work and contributions. And the community laureate is Albany Med's president and my dear friend, Jim Barber. We really encourage you. If you haven't purchased your ticket yet, purchase your ticket to that event. It's going to be again held at CEFQ Arena for the second year in a row. And this is going to be, again, a very, very special occasion for the university to celebrate and recognize these outstanding members of our community. So thank you for your time and your attention. And if there are any immediate questions, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we open up for questions? I know I have a couple. What do you see our role? Because at some point we need to get to the role of this body.
Absolutely.
What do you see our role as in supporting your four pillars?
Well,
and again, yeah. Maybe that our role goes on the next agenda for the next meeting, but I think at some point we want to be aligned with what you want to do. We want to support what you are trying to do for the overall campus. So
I think that's a very important question. It's one that I've given significant thought to as I was thinking about this meeting. Clearly, some of the areas that we've kind of put a stake in the ground, particularly as it relates to advancing new academic degree programs, we've got to make sure we have your support and, where appropriate, your endorsement for moving in those areas. Because these are areas where it's very, very clear to me that based on historical issues, perceptions about what UAlbany should be, UAlbany was basically kind of forbade from moving into some of these academic programs. And there seems to be a climate change now where at least people are not seem to be wedded to those old policies. Because there's a significant shortage of folks in particular disciplines that the private colleges in this region just can't meet all of those needs. There's not a public option for engineering in the capital region. There's not a public option for none of these academic and health sciences related disciplines. And it just makes sense to me that given the investments and given the basic infrastructure that we have at this university, we certainly will solicit your support and supporting from your oversight responsibility the work and a desire to move this university systematically to a different level. And I think we're going to have a rich year of ideas coming before you to get your input on and your support, because I can't say too much about some of these ideas now, but we really have decided that we have to use this opportunity to really drive in a much more aggressive fashion than I probably originally had assumed in getting some of these ideas on the table. What is engineering programs? How do we consolidate our School of Computer and Information Sciences that's scattered across at least 5 different buildings and 2 campuses? To create the synergy to initiate some of this engineering, academic, and research work that we want to get done. So there's going to be a lot coming down. We do plan to strengthen some of our work in public health, as well as think about what would be the right set of programs for us to offer in allied health and medical-related programs as well. That, again, all tied to what the critical needs are in this state at the moment. And that's where the international strategy becomes critical as well, because that will be the place where we're going to be able to attract a certain type of student that we just won't get with the type of programs we have now. And so the out-of-state strategy and international strategy, I think, is going to help drive our research agenda and also add to and address some workforce needs, because we'll be attracting students from parts of the U.S. and internationally that otherwise wouldn't think about.
I was going to ask that question. So do you think Binghamton is attracting this number of international students because of the programs they have, or because they've just made a concerted effort as an institution to attract international students? So it seems to me it's more program-driven, isn't it?
It's all of the above.
Oh, both?
Yes, both. They're one of the biggest...
I know Binghamton.
Well, one of the
There's not much there.
Well, this...
I don't mean the university, but no. I mean this... The city doesn't have a whole lot to offer.
Well,
but on the charts now. I mean,
Well, the school is. Yeah, I understand.
And Binghamton does an excellent job. This is from, I actually going to visit, because I always see things that I talk about, so
right.
I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But my perception is that Binghamton, number one, has done an excellent job of telling his own story. And that's what I talked about in inauguration. We don't tell our story effectively enough. Binghamton has done a good job of not only framing excellence around undergraduate education, a very robust undergraduate experience, they've also started to grow their research portfolio as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some center of excellence down there. They have an outstanding engineering program. And they were one of the schools that aggressively collaborated on this Turkish initiative that SUNY initiated. They probably have the largest number of Turkish students than any other SUNY university center. And so that's where a large number of the international students are from Turkey. But they're attracting students from all over the world. So it's not just an aggressive, first of all, it's a, they have, I think, a good strategic messaging effort around Binghamton being a place to get a world-class undergraduate engaged in learning kinds of activities. But as well, they have the academic programs that are attractive to students from around the world. So it's both.
Mm-hmm. I know what you mean, Michael. We have operations there. I have branches there. When you compare it to my branches around the state, they
downtown
are land caught at time.
Yeah.
They really are. It's, I mean, in no disrespect. I mean, it is from just the way people operate, the financial resources, their employment, literally their amount of sunshine. They have the lowest amount of sunshine of anywhere. So
even lower than Ithaca.
I thought that was Oswego.
So for them to be able to do that, I think is encouraging.
Because
I think we have a tremendous amount to offer.
We have a lot to offer, but
we're not leveraging it, and we're not talking strategic and intentionally about it. And so that's what we have to do. You know, it's not, this is a great place. And I'm not saying it just because I'm here as a president. It's a great university. That's why I came here. And I do think we're poised, if we are thoughtful and very intentional about our strategy, we can move this university significantly in the next 5 years. And I think we're well on our way to doing that. So there will be a number of opportunities for us at this forum to discuss policy issues, implications of these four stakes that we're putting on the ground, in the ground, and how we, and get your input about strategies moving forward.
Well, I would like to, at some point, and Robert and I will talk about it, is, you know, to put on the agenda specific, you know, the issue of the role of the board and the whole issue of governance, and get back to you with more of that so we can have a robust discussion about it. But I just wanted to touch on it. One more question for me, and it's just a point of information for me. There is no requirement for the percentage of students that are state residents. That perception that the state, even though I understand the state's funding is relatively insignificant, but there's no requirement that we or does it look disproportionate if the state university and a significant percentage are coming from out of state or out of the country? Because the economics are obvious. I mean, that's
economics.
The way that we can get over on the economic problem that we have. But that doesn't get looked at negatively. I have no idea.
Yeah, as far as I know, I don't think there's any policy anywhere that says X percentage of the students must come from the state. The fact of the matter is that, as far as I know, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a state with a higher percentage of students enrolled in its four-year campuses. It's not atypical for two-year campuses, but four-year campuses at 90%. And there's not a lot of difference between Stony Brook, Buffalo, and Binghamton, and New Albany in terms of New York residents that are employed here. The big difference is when you add the international element. That's where the separation, where we look dramatically different. This has caused an issue in some states around the country. It was never an issue in Minnesota. I think about 70% of the students in Minnesota are Minnesota residents. But there are some places around the country where you're talking only about 50, 52 to 60% are residents.
Washington, that's one of the issues.
And my understanding is that University of Illinois has increased their international students representation probably about 15% over the last couple of years. And that was very intentional. Part of that strategy, to help cover some of the loss of revenue from the state. And so it's occasionally, if you read the higher education Department of the Press, like Chronicle, you read about states being concerned about it. But in most states, the demographics in terms of young people, unless you're in the deep, in the in the southwestern USA, places like Georgia, states like that, that have college-age population actually increasing, I think most people realize that it's the only way forward. So, but I don't know of any statute.
Well, we are in New York, so we have rules about rules. So I'm just to make sure that there wasn't one embedded somewhere.
Yeah, in Virginia, the legislature tries to cap the schools, and they try to put in different caps for William and Mary versus UVA and so forth. But generally, they top out at about 30% out of state, and that would include at the undergraduate level, including international. Graduate level, all bets are off.
Yeah, and most universities look pretty much the same at the graduate and professional.
Right, it's all international.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But you know, we happen to live next door to a state that's a net exporter of students, which is New Jersey. And I think one simple thing we could do is, since I'm sure we have a lot of alumni living in northern Jersey, is tap into the guidance counselors of northern New Jersey, and for probably a cost that would be covered by literally a couple of students coming here, we could probably do a program for guidance counselors in northern Jersey on what we offer here. And we could probably even bus them here and show them what we offer. And it's, I mean, it's definitely a net exporter of students.
We really have to do out-of-the-box things like that, because otherwise we've got to make sure people understand the assets and the resources.
Right, and it's convenient. It's like literally, I mean, it couldn't be more convenient.
And what we have to our advantage is a very competitive tuition.
Absolutely.
Price. Because it's my understanding that places like Binghamton, the closest to Pennsylvania, using the fact that, you know, it costs $20,000 a year to
We're cheaper for an out-of-state student, I believe, than Rutgers, too.
Right.
So we should, I mean,
Binghamton's definitely getting, in terms of out-of-state, they're getting a big Pennsylvania right there.
Sure.
Yeah, on the border.
Right.
But I would think that that's our low hanging fruit.
It is. And so we've got to really. So we've been having conversations about this. I think what you're probably going to see is that we're either going to form presidential councils or working groups around each of these four states so I can stay more involved and leverage across all of the different departments at the university. Because when you start talking about bringing in more students, it integrates across everything we do, from student success to, you know, academics and a number of other issues as well. And we just want to be very thoughtful and make sure that we need to better understand where we need investments as well. And I think we're going to have to spend some money in order to change the way we do things. It's just
I don't think it takes much, actually.
It won't take much, but the fact is we have to spend some.
Yeah, I agree. So in Binghamton,
we can't do this stuff on the cheap. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It's not going to get you to where we need to be in order to advance this university. So,
other questions?
As far as international students, do you have any specific countries in mind? I mean, you mentioned Turkey for Binghamton. A lot of people think China. I mean, that's an obvious one, but I think a lot of other countries are overlooked when it comes to recruitment.
You're absolutely right. We made our first international trip to Turkey back in June. We had some Turkish visitors here last week who are visiting our School of Business. They have already signed some potential collaboration agreements that's going to bring more students from there to UAB. We will be headed back to Turkey probably in March, but we're also going to Cyprus. We had visitors that came to the inauguration from Japan. And so we're going to be looking at Turkey, Cyprus, Japan. We've been having conversation about other specific Middle Eastern countries where there's a significant number of students that can afford to come and pay out-of-state tuition. There's a growing desire to connect with Brazil, and I have firsthand knowledge of working with, at one point, probably, well, I bet you about 20% of my graduate students were from Brazil. That was hardly a year that went by, I wasn't educating at least one or two graduate students or postdocs from Brazil. And so I think that's a place where we really haven't developed deep relationships and connections. We will continue to pursue China. but we're not putting all of our eggs in that basket because they already represent the largest cohort of our international students. I think we had 440 new students from China this year, wasn't it? Something like that. I may be wrong, but it is. They already represent the largest proportion of our international students. And, we think we have an opportunity to advance this international portfolio in ways that's going to enrich the university, both in terms of our academic programs, the student experience, and in other ways as well.
Your outreach, I think, is right on the money. I remember some years ago, Claude Hombach asked me a question. He said, "Well, Jim, why is it that everybody wants to go to St. Rose and not to the University of Albany when you've got this tremendous facility and so forth?" I said, "One of the problems is that the Brevador is like a DMZ, sort of separates everything out here." And I said, "But you have to have the university come to the city. You have to, you know, talk to people. You have to be involved in their activities. They have to know you personally." Because they just can't walk right through the campus like they did in the old days. So when you had the inaugural week, I saw a different kind of enthusiasm. They were very excited, they were listening, and so forth. And I said, "Well, you know, this is a big positive step forward." And I think that being involved with Albany Promise, those little things where you make those personalized relationships, and they see where they're going to kind of benefit from it, I think it's going to help. Well, I think that's, I'm looking forward to that. That's, to me, a big positive move.
Well, I appreciate that. And that was one of the reasons we did the Capital Region Plus One County Tour.
Sure.
So we did nine counties.
Sure. Well, they get to see you personally. They see,
yes.
And that's a different relationship from when somebody's up there and out there, and you imagine all that. But when they see a person individually, that they're human, they actually breathe, you know, eat, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah. They seem simplistic, but I think that it makes a big difference.
I think that we certainly hope it will make a difference, and we plan to continue to look back to those communities.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think earlier this week, College of Education hosted an event for school superintendents. Again, getting those folks involved, getting them on campus so they can see what we have to offer. All of that is additive. If you keep doing it, you're doing it in a consistent way. We have to send a very strong message about the educational opportunities here and that you can get a world-class education for a fraction of what it costs to go to one of the private institutions.
And I think they're also recognizing in this area that if it was not for the, in those days it was called the Teaching Scholar.
Yeah.
There were suburban schools, they had these high-powered, that's how they started, that was their foundation. And that connection has been, it's not as tight as it used to be. I think that what you're doing now is bringing this back because you and I and everybody else around this table and host, that if you're going to improve things, that high quality individuals, teachers or whatever, engineers, whatever it is, that they have to be well trained to deliver the goods. And I think we can do it here. No question.
Okay.
All
right. Thank you.
If there's nothing else, Joy.
Update from governance. We've approved our Senate designees for the Excellence Award selection committees. And we've also formed the ad hoc committee to examine the larger issues of Senate charges regarding the resignation of CNSC senators and council members. They all, CNSC senators all resigned en masse. And this new committee will be called the Ad Hoc Committee on Senate Implications of the CNSC Transition. Presently, we have three members on there, but we're also looking to add other representatives across the campus. Issues will come up during the year.
Anything else or any questions? No. Gary, are you going to give us a report?
Yes, I certainly can. It's not going to be a long one. The GSA has a new executive board that took off at the end of last year. That initial shakeup because a couple of officers resigned, but they found volunteers and had them approved through the assembly. So we have all of our officers at this point financially, we're doing quite well. We've established a reserve. We've changed the way that we collect fees, and we're focusing on like long-term costs of our contracts and purchases. So our projections are very favorable, especially when you put it compared to where we were at the end of last year. The main update is that the board is actually pursuing a new strategy to coordinate graduate students. They're aiming to build a greater sense of community and solidarity than they had before. So to do that, they're overhauling a lot of the internal bureaucracy, and they significantly changed their outreach methods. They changed the way that they send out listserv announcements. They changed their communication. The result has been a greater level of student involvement overall. They're hoping to channel this into more university activities. We're involved within the university community. The particular point of interest that a lot of attention is currently being focused on is the presidential forum, where President Jones agreed that he will speak to students, and this dialogue has generated a great deal of interest in his opinion regarding the university and his answers to certain questions, and in general has greatly improved the spirit of graduate students with respect to their attitudes towards the administration between this and the interest in the questions of student debt level the past year. That concludes my report.
Any questions of Gary? Saying none. Tim?
Well, I know my predecessor used to bring candy to these events, but I bring colored pages. I just wanted to hand out, this is a two-sided sheet. It shows the staff at the Alumni Association. It indicates in very briefly what their responsibilities are. You'll notice lots of people have associate or director in their title, and the reason for that is we have very few staff. What we do is we leverage students on campus to help us with our events, the Purple and Gold Ambassadors, the student leaders, interns in the office, virtually anybody we can corral to help us with the various events that that we put on to both provide some services to current students and to attract alumni back to the campus. And in that regard, I'll hand out this thing, which talks to a point the president made earlier, which is we have we're attempting, in conjunction with homecoming, a new event called the Great Dane Pregame. This was our first shot at something like this. Our goal was to try and attract 500 alumni back to campus. What we really thought we'd get is a little around, maybe around 300 people, but as of this morning, we have over 700 alumni who have signed up for this. Over 800.
Yeah, he doesn't text
them.
You're getting nervous now.
So we're trying to not make it
too excited to nervous.
That's right. Well, if it keeps going, we'll be talking about Fountain Day again. And we also, I'll just tell you, sometimes I feel sorry for him. We hardly let the president go anywhere other than the men's room, where we don't try and hook him up with alumni somewhere along the way. And we'll continue to do that. I just mentioned, people know this, but I think sometimes it gets forgotten. We do have 160,000 plus living alums. They live in every state and on every continent. And in most countries of the world, and I think that could be potentially a real resource as we travel around the world trying to attract especially the international and out-of-state students. They've established themselves in some of these communities, and they could be a resource for the university in gaining a foothold into some of those local communities and attracting those students, because they're on site and can go to these schools and talk to the kids and tell them what a great time they had here and what a great education they got here. So, we're ready, willing, and able to work with the president and with the development office at any time to further the goals of the university, because that's what we're here for.
Actually, if I may, I just reported to Dr. Jones this morning that this week our alumni chapter in Cyprus volunteered and hosted the college fair in Cyprus, and they actually got 52 applications
for
us.
Wow.
And all great. People sent materials for them, and if you remember last year, we sent the executive director, Lisa Urbella, to officially recognize the Alumni Association there, and now their official chapter. So we sent them the material, we did a little training on the phone, admissions office. And they sent very meticulous. They sent us all the email addresses, all the names, and we were working with them. So that's one example of them working for us.
Yeah.
All three alumni has worked the booth for 7 hours, and they got 52 names.
Wow.
Which side of Cyprus?
Oh, we are in the Greek side.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it was interesting because there were 4 students, and they were identified as from the occupied territory.
Ah.
I have as a point of reference, a very distinguished alum friend of mine is Cypria, the president of the University of South Carolina. He goes here all the time. If you wanted to go speak to the Alumni Association, or the alumni group there, I'm sure he would.
As long as
he was interviewed for
What's that?
He was interviewed for the magazine article.
Right.
Yeah,
He's Cypriot, and he does go there.
Yeah, we'd have to send our own president there.
I'm bigger than he was. Yeah. He's my roommate. I'll beat him up.
Those days are long gone. Did we finish the alumni report? Okay.
Yes.
Then under old business, our 2013 research report. James?
So I will talk to you really about our research report in terms of finances, not in terms of publications and a lot of the good work that folks are doing. So usually start out by talking about how we are comparing to other units within the SUNY system. And so these are our research expenditures all in, and at UAlbany in this past fiscal year they're around $87 million. College of Nashville Science and Engineering is around $325 million. And much of their research expenditures are large tools that they're bringing in to the clean rooms for use. You'll see we just had a conversation about Binghamton, all in there at around $40 million. And then, of course, Buffalo and Stony Brook are about double what our expenditures are. Please feel free to stop me as we go along. Now, one of the business classifications for expenditures is a term called organized research. And this is generally, this type of research has a very high yield in terms of facilities and administrative costs, usually around 50% if it's the NIH. So if you get $1 million, you get another $500,000 in facilities and administrative costs. So we like to try and drive our people towards this kinds of federal funding, because the FNA costs that we cover, we can do some things here to help incentivize new research. You can see how the picture, how the field sort of changes when you're comparing Albany and Binghamton, when you're looking at just our organized research portfolio. And we're more on equal ground there, whereas in the previous picture I showed you, our expenditures are higher, and I'll explain that in a moment. But again, you can see that Buffalo and Stony Brook's organized research expenditures are quite high. CNSC, all the tools that they buy, they put in as organized research, and that has some implications as
and
well.
Jim, before
you leave this slide, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong. One of the important distinguishing characteristics that sets, I think, Buffalo and Stony Brook apart in this category would have to do with the fact that they have medical school?
That's correct. And to that point, if you look at downstate and upstate, which are just primarily medical schools, and their organized research portfolios are actually better than ours.
I just wanted to point that out.
Yep. And so Now, Binghamton, of course, is a very serious engineering school. So if you combine engineering and medicine, you know, you could be starting to push up.
Do we have short, intermediate, or long-term goals for the size of our bar?
That's one of the stakes.
Yeah. Okay. One of the president's stakes in the ground is to increase our external sponsored funds portfolio to double it in the next 10 years. That's a 7% increase per year. That means that with the current state of federal funding, one of the things that you guys can help us do is to bring industry to the table to say, I know a bunch of smart guys that can help you do the research that you need to do. And we'll take that money and we'll bring it in through the Research Foundation and we'll make our bar move up. And we need to do that on a fairly large scale.
But the other thing I want to point out, and again, it's kind of a downer when you think about it, when you look at the CNSE component of this, and when you add that up until whatever point it was separated away from you all being, do you understand how this campus was fundamentally above Stony Brook and Buffalo in terms of it blew me away when I first saw the combined numbers, because what Jim is not also showing you is roughly $100 million that comes through the partnership.
I'll show you that in the moment.
Well, you're going to show them in the moment. That comes through our partnership with the Department of Health. So for a university of the size that it is, and I'm still operating until it's formally no longer part, that with CNSE, it put us at over 500, wasn't it pretty close to 500 million? And I'll just give you some context. University of Minnesota, 68,000 students, 5 campuses, 840 million. So I just wanted to kind of, the fact that this place evolved with that kind of stellar research profile is first of all very unique. But it also hopefully will provide some hope and aspiration that we can get to. We just got to keep innovating, I guess is the point I'm trying to make, because we've done it before and we'll have to do it again.
And I think if you can
start. I'm sorry to hijack your report, Jim.
No, I was just going to comment on, you know, when we talk about goals for the bars, it's really this bar that matters.
Which
ones we're looking at.
Organized research.
Because at the end of the day, if you just get research dollars without any overhead, in effect, we probably lose money on it. So, and I found when we were sitting on the search committee here, I don't know if you noticed this, we have faculty that didn't understand that, oh great, let's get all these other research, you know, we're doing all this research, but it was like death by a thousand cuts.
Right.
And so, it's this bar that really will make a difference and matters. And that's really where we have to have our goals. Not so much against, I think, the other.
No.
I mean, the big tunnel looks nice, but
if you look at,
not if we're going to lose money on it.
But just to nuance that point a bit, if you look at CNSE expenditures, which is primarily driven by industry coming in through RF, their overall F&A rate is only 4 to 6%.
Mm-hmm.
But the scale is so
big,
large,
yeah,
that
building, and every time they build a building, there it is. It's popping up those expenditures. So
you know, my way of thinking about that is, how can we do that too?
Yeah.
So this is really speaking directly to what you just mentioned. So this is a pie chart of the different kinds of things we do and the external funding that we bring in. So one of the things that distinguishes Albany from Binghamton, Stony Brook, and Buffalo is that our public service, our workforce development, our professional development program, our training is a huge part of our external research, part of our external funding that we bring in. Only 32% of our portfolio is organized research. Binghamton is at 70%, Stony Brook is 78%, and Buffalo is 82%. One of the consequences of that is that if you look at our F&A rate of return, our average F&A rate is 18%. So you can just do the numbers very quickly. If you got 100 million, it's really 18 million. Whereas Buffalo is 31%, 29% for Stony Brook, and 35% for Binghamton. If you look at how we compare to downstate, not surprisingly, because or upstate, because they're primarily medical, everything they do is going to focus almost around this organized research portfolio. Again, very high in the hospitals. So anyway, I'm not sure if Joyce made copies of this talk for you guys, but we'll push it out to you as a
We'll include it in the minutes, Jim.
So, okay. This is what Robert was speaking about, is if you look at how we compare to some of our peer institutions, so Georgia Institute of Technology at $650 million. Now, we count HRI funding, but only those faculty, only those health department employees who have an appointment in the School of Public Health or other departments who are training our graduate students and who are training postdocs who train our graduate students. And so they're about $100 million. And then, of course, this is with CNSE with us. These are 2011 values because the National Science Foundation Hertz survey is, I think, about 2 years to catch up when they publish this. But one of the consequences of CNSE dropping off of our portfolio, and they started reporting independently to NSF in 2012, is that reduces our ranking. So we're here at 123 all in. That's going to reduce our ranking in the NSF Hertz survey. And then compared to some of our aspirational peers, again, you know, we're doing well all in, but once you remove the CNSE piece, we're going to have to regain our position there in some ways. And you know, there are, one of the points that was made is that the nature of the type of external funding that we get affects our overall revenue. And so the RF Central assesses all of the money that we get as a total direct cost, and they do it on a three-year rolling average. So this year, for example, they only weigh 50% of what we brought in, and they have a tithe on our total all-in costs of 3%. 0.3% of that goes to the chancellor, and 2.7 goes for their operating budget centrally. So if we make 100 million, they're multiplying that by 3%, and they're taking that, subtracting it from our F&A costs, and then returning the rest of the F&A costs to the campus. So to the extent that the portfolio has a lot of external sponsored funds that doesn't generate F&A, we're actually paying to take those grants, which is what you were talking about. So I don't say to those folks that you shouldn't take those grants, because we are a diverse disciplinary.
But strategically.
But what I do tell them is try to diversify. Let us help you look for those federal opportunities that could help you to get that federal money. Don't just take the easy stuff. Go for the hard stuff too, because in the end that helps everybody. And that's a message that I think Robert is right on the same page with me on. And we recently had to negotiate with one of our units to get a little bit more of that F&A. They were trying to use as a cost share, and I think it all worked out for them. So this is just some of our historical assessment from the Research Foundation. So they're taking 3.2 million in the last fiscal year out of our F&A, so that returns to us, you know, less than 10 million. And we have a campus policy that we return 10% of the amount that's returned to the campus. So we would push out to the units about $950,000, and that gets distributed to the units. And before I came in, it was just sort of divvied up. based on the total direct cost, but when I came in, I started to metric it based on the F&A that they brought in. So their contribution to the F&A pool determines what they get back in that $950,000 pool. And they use that for really important things, sending students to meetings, helping their faculty to get some initial data that they may need for funding and so forth and so on. Our concern at this point is that when I came into this job, I was seeing, you know, on average about a 5 to 6% increase per year. So I thought we were on the right track. What we're seeing now is a decline in expenditures. Following, and expenditures usually follow awards. So we're looking at a decline in expenditures that follow the decline in awards from the previous year. And so our projected expenditures going forward, based on what our awards were in the past year, looks like we're leveling out. But I'm a little concerned that they may be decreasing slightly. So as I said before, initially we were looking at a 5% increase if you take an average across time. But we're starting to actually decrease in terms of annual growth. This is in part due to the sequester, which is affecting other institutions in the system as well. So our overall change this year in expenditure is 18%. Binghamton is down by 13%. And then there's a range of 4 to 6% in the other units. And I had anticipated, based on the sequester, that we would be down by about 5%. So the question is, why are we down by more than that?
Just before you leave, I think it's important to note as well, as you notice, CNSE is not impacted.
They're carrying the whole RF system at this point, because of this. So there's a couple ways to think about that. One is that in numbers they're carrying us.
Right.
But when you look at actual F&A to run things.
Right. Isn't part of this as well is if you look at the total amount of sponsored research they bring in, it's probably only about 17
million. It's not that
much. It's probably about 17 million. That's one of the biggest misperceptions about that unit, is that they're bringing all this federal money in from the federal government, and it's not. It's only about 17 million out of the 300 to 400 million that they
all. This is your tax dollars at work.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Building a business.
So my thought is, how do I get some of that?
I was just going to pick up on what the president was saying. What's the split if you had the percentages, state, industry, federal for CNSE?
Yeah, I think their external federal sponsored research is around 12 something like that.
I have it somewhere.
When we were dropping by the 18%, was the assessment line still going up?
Because the assessment is based on total direct. So let me go back to the previous slide.
Yeah, maybe I saw it wrong, but yeah. Go back to, it was not that one, the one before, those slides before.
Yeah, the $3 million.
You mean, why are we still being, so this is projected, so let's talk about this one. Why are we still at 3.3%,
right.
$3.3 million?
Based on the previous
rolling average. So they do that so that we don't get hurt, because if we...
It looks like it hurts.
It hurts when you're going that way, and it helps when you're going that way, right?
If they do it based on each year, then the return to campus is going to be doing this effect. So they try to lock.
So that drops. That drop from 106 to 87 will be reflected.
Believe me, you're talking like a faculty member, and most faculty members say, why are we giving that much to the Research Foundation? So this is some of the underpinning of why we dropped 18%. And so when you have big projects and those projects lose their funding, you have big losses. So CAS, the College of Arts and Sciences, they, it's not that they had a loss, it's just that in this year, 2011-2012, we had the $5.5 million ERA funding for the RNA Institute build-out. That went away, so we're down 5%.
That, and that's really what's affecting a lot of the state declines, too, is that the ERA money coming off.
Right, that's correct. That's part of it.
It's dried up.
And then the Center for International Development, which came to us, I think, in 2007 or 2008, from Central, their expenditures are declining. They lost the Afghanistan project and Lebanon. And so this is a huge hit for us. And we actually make a huge investment there because we're funding their front office because they can't charge fully for all of those folks. So we plow a lot of our indirect costs that they generate back into their front office. And so, you know, they're working pretty hard to get that number back up, and we need to support them in order to be able to, for them to do that. The professional development program run by Jean Monaco, they're actually one of the solutions to our F&A problem because of the scale of work that they do. They generate a tremendous amount of F&A, probably about a quarter of the F&A that they generate. But you can see that their expenditure profile is decreasing as well. Part of this is also due to the sequester because a lot of what they get is federal flow through OTA, OCFS. I'm probably taking too long here, so feel free to just cut me off. I just wanted to give you an update on where we are in the first quarter of this year that we're in now. Right now, our expenditures are sort of level as to where they were last year. We're not down very much. If you're looking at the other campuses, Binghamton is down by 10%. Now, that's not a lot of money. It's, you know, $8 million versus $9 million. Buffalo's up by 5%. Stony Brook, which had not dropped that much last year, is down by 18% in the first quarter. I think what you're seeing here is you're still seeing effects of sequester, and it's too early to tell, but you know, we'll update you as we go through the next quarters.
What's the big difference in nano to 16?
Every time they get an instrument, a tool,
yeah,
it goes up.
It's all construction related.
They don't use the tool, the company uses the tool. How is that?
Because it comes in through the research through foundation. They classify it as organized research.
Yeah, there's no cash to that.
Well, there is some F&A money that's associated with it. So, okay. I just want to say that although we have a campus policy of returning to the units 10% of what comes back to the campus, in reality, I have a pot of money that I'm given, and I incentivize and seed projects to try and generate additional funding. So, for example, one of the projects we provided some funding for was Jesse Ernst, who's a physicist, and he's doing his experiments at the Super Hadron Collider in CERN in Switzerland. You may have noticed that there was a Nobel Prize given out this week in physics for the folks who discovered the Higgs boson. And it's thought that the next Nobel Prize will be actually be given to CERN. And so our scientists are a part of that. And so Jesse and Vivek Jain, a new physics professor, came to me and said, we want to go back to the Department of Energy, 51.5%, and we need a little bit of money for a postdoc for a couple of years. So I used that money to incentivize them to do that. So CAS really gets about 23% of that a return of what they generate. So these are percents of what you generate return to you. And the others are getting around 10%. Social welfare is got a little bit more. Again, it's not a huge number, but we're plowing some money back into them because with the audit that we had, some of the folks, like in the doing evaluative research, if they're writing grants and writing reports, they can't charge their time direct time to the grants. So they're generating $2.4 million. so for me, it's kind of a small investment to go back in and say, I'll pay for 5% of your people. Just keep writing those grants and bringing that money in. Okay, so when you get this PDF, there's a whole bunch of slides in this deck that are like this, but just to orient you, these are our different schools across the board here, in addition to the Division of Research, the units that report to me, some of our centers like the Atmospheric Science Research Center. And those guys, the triangles above the line, are those guys who did better than last year, and the guys below the line are the guys who did worse than last year. And of course, you know, some of the money isn't a lot of money, but for example, in the school of business. But so in arts and sciences, you know, we're looking at that $5 million decrease from the RNA Institute. But there's also some problem areas there that that particular dean needs to look at and ask, why did we drop by that much? And so I've shared this data with the provost executive advisory committee, and they're aware of it. And then in your slide deck that you'll get, there's a breakout of each unit. And I'm not going to go into that today. But you can see, for example, the different departments within each unit, and look to see for yourself. And then I'm happy to talk to you about any of this information going forward. I think that is. I'll just mention one more thing. This is some of our dashboards in terms of innovation, development, and commercialization. We're in the process of trying to hire an assistant, maybe associate VP for innovation partnerships, who will be working with us to really take ownership of the Startup New York portfolio, as well as to develop industry relationships for us to fund our research. Probably one of the things that, not probably, but one of the things that I'll be having to work on also immediately is our opportunity to develop a statewide MESA-net and how we would fund that. So importantly, our patent applications, I think, are going in the right direction. Our patents, we do spend a bit of money on this, and in the past, there hasn't been an investment in that, but that's one of the metrics that the chancellor is looking for. It's one of the things that we need to be doing. So we are, I think, headed in the right direction now that we've begun to fund some of this, and there's a lag time that's involved. We need to do better on our licensing income, but that means we need to have boots on the ground, looking at those faculty who are willing to disclose what they're doing and turn those disclosures either into patents or into know-how that we keep secret or in software and licensing applications. So I think I'll stop there. I just want to mention one more thing, is we are trying to move the dial in terms of the money that we're getting from the state to do research. And just a couple of examples. For example, in the School of Criminal Justice, we have engaged in some MOUs with the Division of Criminal Justice Services and the Division of Correctional Services. We're putting our postdocs, embedding them behind their firewalls so we can work on their sensitive databases, and we're collaborating with our faculty and their people to do research that's going to inform the governor about how the governor should proceed in terms of when people are released from prison, what do we do, and what are we doing when they're behind the wall. So we'd like to see more of that activity as well. And I think I'm going to stop there. So, and I'll take any questions.
Questions.
And I've mentioned this to you before, but now I guess kind of the same challenge that Mike threw out earlier, but what can this group do to move those numbers the right direction? I mean,
So a conversation that I often have with Bardeen is, we have all these alumni and we have all these connections. Are we really effectively using that Rolodex to bring those people to the university with their potential research problems? A lot of small businesses, as you know, don't have the horses to do the research, but they've got a potential product that they need to get evaluated. So I think going forward, we've made a commitment to each other to partner and try and really push the dial in that direction. I think telling our story is really critically important to bringing industry partners to the table, and I don't think we've necessarily done that. If you've looked at the research magazines that we've designed in the past couple years since I've been here, I'm trying to put out there that we're open for business, and we're not just in our ivory towers doing our little thing. And so if you have suggestions about that magazine that we put out there, if you have lists of people that we should be sending that to, if you want us to go meet with them, we'll do that as well. So we're trying not to be ignorant and trying to get out there. So that can be a really huge help to us. One of the things that Binghamton does very well, and I've always been very impressed with it, is that they also integrate industry into their doctoral student dissertation committees. They bring them into campus as part of their curriculum, and they become invested in the campus. I was telling Robert, I was just at Binghamton for a vice president for research meeting, and I was walking through their new centers that they've built. There was some property that was owned by NYSEG, and they've gutted it and redone it. And everywhere you go, they've got signs of the businesses that are operating in that facility. We don't do that here. You know, it was almost verboten, right, before. Well, Startup New York's changed that. So what I'd love to see is those signs all over in the life sciences research building, all over.
Do each of the various departments, like the physics department, do they have an alumni board of some sort or advisory?
They have an advisory board.
Those boards might be the place to make some of those. I mean, obviously, that's what the school business has done in terms of it's accounting alums.
It depends on the dean and the department chair as how much they want to get that board involved. And we have some boards that have not met in 3 or 4 years.
That doesn't work.
Yeah.
David is very active.
David, for example, perfect example. Don Siegel, excellent.
Right.
David Roussel came on board. He said, I'm going to make a change. So over the last 18 months or a year, he has been on the road everywhere trying to get a very strong board for Rockefeller College because he made fundraising a priority. And there are some departments here who are desperate for funding. We call them, and they don't even return our calls.
And they wonder.
But they do complain. That is the reality of it. And so we often maybe get criticized why we work with certain certain departments more because they want to work with
right.
us. And it takes a long time.
Yeah, it does take a long time.
It takes a long time. Absolutely. To develop a relationship, develop a trust. That is, in developing a trust, just going there with your hand out doesn't mean that's not a fundraising strategy.
Right.
To paint a bright picture for research on a going forward basis, there are three big ideas that are going to help move that dial. Our 2020 plan calls for 200 new faculty, research getting, grant getting faculty. Startup New York will enable us to partner with industry to drive industry research in concert with our faculty working here. And if we are successful in advancing these new academic programs in high needs areas, engineering, allied health, and big data, that'll open up doors at the federal level that we cannot pursue today. So the future is bright, and we got a lot going for us as we move forward.
But I'm impatient.
One of the problems why business doesn't interact with the university is because they're on different time scales. And part of our job is to help train our faculty about the difference in time scales. It's not glacial. It's really because if you don't move fast enough, you die.
I think one of the problems why the business community doesn't interact is because they don't know that the resources was there. I really think it's the best kept secret. I mean, I've been embedded in this community for 25 years. I drive by every day. I just don't think that the industry knows to turn to when they have a problem.
It's telling a story.
It is the best kept, which to me is a great thing, because now we just tell the story, right? And we can do that. Because I think there are organizations that would love to integrate with the university.
And your time comment is very telling. I mean, my working life once had a vice president at GE, and what he said was, and he went just like this. He said, there's business time, and then there's regular time, and then there's academia. And he said, business people go nuts trying to deal with the. So unless you get somebody, you know, Dean Siegel is a good example of somebody who understands that and can, you know, and can buffer that kind of thing. But you really need people in academia who can make that crossover for you.
This is maybe an impolitic question, but in the business world, might we be, in terms of getting research, might we be competing with our own faculty who do that sort of work on their own? They're allowed to, based on their contract, I assume, do independent work for, in other words, contract with business to do market research, for instance, or something of that nature. So we sort of compete with our own.
I'd love to bring that in.
What's that?
I'd love to bring that in and get some F and A from that.
Yeah, really.
But how much of that is actually happening, I guess?
I don't know. That's a
I've hired faculty over here in the past.
Yeah. I mean,
well, heck, we have student projects that are in effect research assignments that we put them all out.
And you know, the skill is maybe not that great, but the concern is that where is the experiential learning for our students when you go off and consult on your own time off campus? And you know, God bless you if you can, but you're not sharing that experience with your students. Whereas when someone gets an external sponsored funds contract or grant, for example, I have a contract right now with a Swiss biotech company to compare two biosimilars. And that brings money to the university that can be plowed into our system. And so I think it's, you know, there are choices and things that are done. And when you're doing something else outside, that's not necessarily reputationally benefiting the university or our student experience or training. But it is, you know, available for our faculty, and it's value added to what they do here. So it's kind of a balance.
I'd be surprised if that's our biggest problem. I just don't think it is, because as part of the academy, it has been for a long time, and it does contribute to the reputation of.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm wondering if it's a phenomenon that exists. It seems to me a lot of. In the old days, anyway, a lot of universities used to encourage faculty to do outside consulting.
Universities in
Europe. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But
I think that the biggest barrier for us is our faculty need to write more grants. They need to have the time to do that. And then they need to have the infrastructure that helps them go after the big grants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's key.
But maybe that means that...
That's the problem.
In addition to calling on all those guidance counselors, we set aside some money for a couple of grant writers. I don't know if you can leverage them or...
University of Buffalo.
Or postdocs, maybe, or I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but focus.
Yep. Well, it goes back to what I said earlier. We've got to spend some money if we're going to change things. And
but maybe the message
The message has to be changed, because I'm glad that Jim mentioned the notion that, because part of what you see, I think, in the declining awards has to do with, I'm willing to bet you, have the number of grants we submitted over that time period declined as well?
They have. There are some nuances to that. For example, the National Science Foundation, in 3 years ago, we had 117 applications going to the National Science Foundation for a total of $48 million. This past fiscal year, we had 69 applications. That's almost half.
Now,
can't win the lottery unless you place a bet, right?
That's right.
Part of that is that NSF has put a scripture on this now, mm-hmm. and so they're limiting the calls. They're in sequestration. They're in, you know. So part of it is, you know, shame on the federal government for not supporting research to the extent that other nations are supporting research, and we're falling behind the curve, particularly in areas of energy where, you know, the Assistant Secretary for Energy said that if we're going to be, he was here in Albany, and he said if we're going to compete with the rest of the world in clean energy and energy storage, we could win that because the United States is entrepreneurial. We tolerate failure, whereas in other countries they don't. That's the only edge that we have. If you then take away and the playing field by decreasing federal funding for energy research, now you're taking your advantage away. So.
And speaking as a faculty member who also is, I'm with CCI, but I'm education, so I also have a foot in the door with the
CCI?
College of Computing and Information.
Okay, Studies. Just but I'm glad I wasn't the only one that wasn't right. sure what that was.
But my field is education. Assessment. Mm-hmm. So I'm the director of the School of Remedial Programs. It's very difficult to get education grants of any significance. And as a faculty member who's an associate professor, which I'm glad of the tenure process, but it doesn't add to my promotion to the next level. If I get grant applications that aren't funded, and to write a grant takes just as much work as to write a research paper. So I weigh, do I go after this grant when, NSF has turned me down because I don't have funding from NSF. Mm-hmm. So in order to get funding from NSF, I need funding from NSF. Or do I write this research paper because that's going to count at, you know, for the next step. Yeah. And then speaking about consulting, outside consulting, well, yeah, I'm currently working with New York State Education Department. They're giving me data to look at the impact of or the presence of librarians in schools. Mm-hmm. They're not paying me. They don't have the money to pay me. I'm doing it because I can get a research publication out of that. Do I tell them, no, I don't want to do this when it does inform my research and my teaching? Exactly, I say yes. Right. So of course I say yes. So it's not, it's not just as simple as.
I understand. And I think our next session we may want to include kind of that educational session you gave Pierre and Dan and I last year, kind of explaining Albany Budget 101 and how it all works, because that's the other piece of all of this.
But I think this is a good discussion because, as I said earlier, you know, increasing our sponsored research is one of the stakes we put in the ground, and everything we've been talking about for the last several minutes is giving hopefully a good indication of the challenges we face in meeting that target. Some of the obstacles or barriers that we've created, which I will tell you, we've been working away at one of the reasons that faculty members are or somewhat reluctant to write grants now, because we haven't had a very rigorous process of what we call post-award.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And serving faculty well, once they get, people get frustrated.
Yeah.
And they say, why should I go after this grant when I get it? Then I can't get reports out. I have difficulty implementing the grant because of infrastructure.
Right.
So we're starting to work on some of those issues as well. What he was about to allude to, the question you raised about grant writing. We've had conversations about if we have to move beyond going after just a single investigator. $150,000 grant at a time is not going to move the dial for us. You have to be prepared to bring faculty together from across a large number of disciplines and go after the large multidisciplinary grants. Here we're talking $25 million grants. Those are the ones that we have to create the synergies within this university and the support system. And don't get me wrong, most big universities don't do this well. They're just starting to figure out
is one of the biggest problems I had at Minnesota, was how do I get people from across disciplines to come together to go after these big Senate grants. And one of the things that was fortunate to me, I had a young non-tenure track professor over veterinary medicine who didn't know enough not to go after one of these. And there were some senior folks that tried to persuade her not to do it. $150 million later, she brings in one of the biggest grants to the university because she didn't know any better not to try. So what does that say? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I like that message. But anyway, I hope you get my point. We just really have to understand some of these issues, understand what the barriers are, and then systematically make sure that we're creating the connections with the business sector. We have to create the connections, I think, with the state of New York, because we had a meeting with NYSTAR today. It was a very helpful meeting, I thought, Jim. It was a very helpful meeting because then it became very clear to us again. We're the only university center that does not, once NANO leaves, NANO has 99.9% of the grants that represent you all being as a part of their different centers of excellence and the innovation centers that they have. All of the funding that is registered under you all being is the funding that goes to NANO.
Right.
$25 plus million. When NANO leaves, we will be the only university center that doesn't have a significant amount of NYSTAR support. So we just gotta be aggressive and be impatient, Pat. Unlike you.
We need a roadmap, and then I think it's gotta be integrated with development. So
absolutely.
We know what the message is, steer all those people that are maybe one
with communications.
With alumni. I mean, just and work it.
Well, I think this was a great discussion. I certainly know a whole lot more now than I did before, so thanks, Jim.
Thanks,
Jim.
This was great. Thanks, Jim.
If there is nothing else on that, we'll go to the business. We need a motion to adopt the resolution confirming our action on naming rights from our last meeting. Would somebody like to make that motion?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Who seconded? I'm sorry.
James,
thank you.
Discussion on the motion.
Sorry. Should we add the Performing Arts Center to that? I'm just
the practice.
Maybe it's the line for me between philanthropic and not philanthropic is very fuzzy. I'm throwing that throwing it out. If people want to reject it, it's okay. I don't know, I'd never been there before. We were sitting there the other day. I'm like, somebody might want to move this place. I don't know.
That is on the philanthropic side, but I think what you're working on is non-philanthropic.
I'm flexible if anybody wants to name anything.
If someone wanted to put their name on there and they get some of our recording artists, that would, and then I'm out.
I don't know, the Disney, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just occurred to me.
I'd like to defer to the professionals. What do you guys think? This is your area. Does it hurt us to put it on here and then reverse course?
No, it doesn't hurt us because in your way, the philanthropic gift comes, the name goes according to you.
Okay. We can go either way.
It could go either way. Yeah. It's just
by putting it on here, it helps us.
Yeah.
And it does. There's no downside.
There's no downside.
So would the maker and the seconder of the motion allow that amendment?
Sure.
James, is that okay with you? Okay. That it will be amended. Is there anything else on the question? If not, let's move the question. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Was that opposed or in favor?
I think it was an aye. Rob,
was that you?
No, that was John. Yep.
Yeah, I was aye too.
So okay. You're all in favor. Okay. Great. So very unanimous. Okay, we have two more items that we need to address. And one, I think from a parliamentary standpoint, I need to ask that we waive the requirement for 1 week notice of action. And I believe we need a motion to that effect. This is a late-breaking issue with one of the gifts from First Niagara. and it was not in your packet that went out a week in advance. So, is there a second?
Second.
All in favor of waiving that requirement, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
My timing better. Okay. Carried unanimously.
I just didn't
mean okay, now, Pardeen, if you would take us through.
This is hilarious.
Let's get a resolution on the table first. I think you see it. The resolve that the berm on the north side of the stadium and the university's multi-sports complex be named the first Niagara Family Berm. In recognition of the gift of $125,000 by First Niagara Bank to the University of Olson. Could somebody make that motion?
Sure.
Tim, second by Pat. All right, on the motion. Pardon?
Yeah, the gift meets our minimum requirement for naming the berm within the guideline that was established by the council. And we would like your approval for naming that.
And the guidelines based on what we had established?
The cost, the size.
The cost and the percentage of the cost?
Yes.
And is this a philanthropic one?
It's a philanthropic.
It's a more professional curiosity.
Yes,
procedural.
This is philanthropic?
Yes.
This is a hidden.
So it's a permanent.
Is that a permanent name?
It's a permanent name. It's philanthropic.
It's not a permanent, it's a hill.
It's a mound.
And they also gave additional funds, but that's marketing that we're not going to bring that in.
Okay.
This is a bargain. This is a bargain. I thought that was a great idea. I immediately saw it, and I called my marketing guy and said, what are you doing?
Hey, we
can open it back up a bit. We'll build another one.
No, that's
it. Watch it for the berm.
Let me ask you a question, though. Perhaps I've got my geography a bit confused, but what if at some point when demand for seating becomes such that we want to put bleachers on the berm? Does it become First Niagara bleachers, or how did you deal with it?
Because I thought that was the area for expansion.
It is one of the areas for expansion.
I don't have an answer to that question.
It'll be the First Niagara berm now buried by the bleachers.
But most places they have the field is named, the stadium is named.
When you draft the agreement, make sure that you've covered this. That's all it comes down to.
Yes.
I don't have an answer for that.
Well, we better check on that because we don't want that to come back to be a problem.
Okay. But if there is
all
an agreement,
all you have to do is mix it in the agreement.
But they may not agree.
But if they don't agree,
then you better get it out now so that you don't have a problem later when you do try to do that, and then you won't be able to do that.
Do you have a suggestion?
Is there a memorandum of understanding that's
yes, there has been an MOU that was signed.
You better amend it because it probably doesn't have it in there.
Okay. No, it doesn't have it in there. I know that because if I did, if it did, I would have known.
Sure. So can we amend this motion, would the maker of the motion amend this motion to say subject to provisions for the condition of the build out of the stadium with respect to that berm?
Give them a right of first offer to promote that build out if in fact it comes.
Right.
So what you're saying here, if bleachers go there, then they cannot have their name on it anymore.
So it'll be covered up? No.
No, it won't be covered up.
Yeah.
It will not be covered up
anymore.
Michael,
what you should do is give them a right of first offer to take that and promote that, right, guys? And then if they refuse to do that, then unfortunately, they have to have a backup plan.
There will be First Niagara bleachers.
Isn't this 25 grand we're talking about?
No, it's 125.
Oh, 125?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of money, and they should be aware of what's going to happen, and they probably assume that if bleachers are there, then they will be called in.
Okay. Well, I'll discuss this with athletics, see.
Yeah, maybe we're talking about two different things. I thought that right there where that berm is, Lee told me that is where, if we were to expand, that's where
that's true.
Just one of the areas of actual physical expansion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is one of the areas based on what I was told as well.
And so the berm will go away.
Right.
That's correct.
All right. Okay. I'll discuss this with Lee, see what kind of an arrangement was made with the First Niagara.
So we put a subject to clause in, right?
Yeah.
Steve, you got that? So we as a council are covered,
okay.
And we have thrown the hot potato to you.
Okay.
Is Is there any other discussion on this motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried unanimously. I got the timing right on that.
I have another naming opportunity
right. And I didn't know this was going to even come up, and I didn't know it was subject to that, but I have something to do with it, so I'm going to recuse myself.
Put the fear of God in your marketing guy.
Who's the vice chair? Who's running the meeting you're out?
Pierre.
Oh, yeah. Negative.
Wake up!
CIPCU has pledged $100,000 to University at Albany Foundation in recognition of their generosity. We would like their luxury suite to be named at the stadium for CIPCU. That's a luxury suite that seats 10 people, and that is within the minimum that we have established for a luxury suite at the university. And the Alumni Association paid the same amount. And I should know, you should know that CIPCU also paying additional $125 for other marketing initiatives and philanthropic initiatives. But the reason they wanted to be 100 here is because that's how much they also pay for another suite in town. So they didn't want the other place to kind of come see you guys gotta give us another 25. Michael giving the other 25 differently to the athletics.
So 100 plus is giving 25 additional, or 100 plus 125
in the 100 plus is another 25.
Okay.
But now, let me understand, is this marketing or no. Is this philanthropic? I'm trying to understand, yes. I mean, when is this a permanent?
The suite will be named the CIPCU suite.
Okay.
And they get in perpetuity. And they get to use the suite for 5 years. After 5 years, they have the right of the first refusal not to rent it for $5,000 something, $5,000 a year.
But the name will stay.
The name will stay at CIPCU. Yeah. So.
Do you have any beds there? It's just
we have seven football games there.
Yeah. Okay. What about soccer games?
So tell you what the market. So tell you what the market is. The Times Union Center here to have a suite that seats 18 people is $100,000 a year.
Okay.
And they hold much, much more events there. So that's what.
But do they have an annual charge as well?
No, you don't get your name on it.
That's
$20,000 a year. I'm sorry.
$20,000
a year to have your to use the suites at the Times Union Center.
Hey, that was Robert. I had to just switch phones.
Okay. Am I clear on how we? Went
so, out? But it's $5,000 in perpetuity to use that suite.
$5,000 a year.
In perpetuity?
No.
Renewable
every year.
They will have the right every year.
After a year?
Yes, after a year, depending
on the national championships.
Right now.
Well,
right now, if somebody wanted to come and rent the suites for a year, they have to pay us $5,000.
Okay. I mean, I think price is fine now, but I'm assuming 5 years or 10 years from now.
Whatever the market is.
Okay.
Yeah. And when the new suite is built and the bleachers designed the berm, all those in favor?
Pierre, one thing. I think before we do it, you need to formally ask for approval to waive the 1 week period so that we can address this. So we need
have a motion to waive the 1 week.
Yes.
Second.
All those in favor of waiving?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? I have a motion on the resolution regarding the naming. Jim, Pat, second. Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Just make sure it's noted that Michael recused himself.
I will.
And was out of the meeting for his hearing on the questions.
Your chairman.
There's white smoke.
I just wondered about going for the game.
we have a box.
I know.
We have to all get into your box now.
Kevin, hold it.
Some people have already been in my box.
That's adding that zero to it made a lot of difference.
We call them squatters.
That's right. So can I seriously give my opinion on that for a second now that it's done? I think we should be very careful in naming in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Because if our name is on that forever, it's going to be very difficult to resell that if for some reason we don't want to re-up it. So I think that the university should just, this is my advice from the other side, that we should be careful with that.
Okay.
Anytime you name something forever, I think.
You never know what's going to happen down the line.
Once
you get
the
unrun box.
Who knows what SFQ will turn into? We could, you know, be some brand that, you know, the university doesn't want to associate with. After I'm long
not under your not under that's your right. leadership.
That's an Anderson.
Fortunately, we'll all be gone too.
Okay. With that, I think that we are done except for announcements.
I have one bit of news, and I really hate to bring it up because it is conflicting with the homecoming. But it's the ACT conference, which is in Saratoga. We do have sessions with shared governance. With Jim Lattis will be up there in Startup New York. I can send you agenda. I recommend that you come to homecoming, but in the event that you want to come up and listen to Jim Latris or the Chancellor or whatever and find it at Saratoga.
What's the afternoon agenda? Can you do both? I mean, can you get to the football game at least?
Yes.
Yes. Quickly? From there? Because I'm going to be there.
Yep.
I'm ready.
Yep. Hope so. I never know.
I thought it was great that the Chancellor came to the last football game.
Oh, she was there.
Oh, really?
She had a great time. She was really impressed.
She's from Ohio. She's a football fan.
Yeah, that's true. It's like a religion out there.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good point.
Right there.
I think she was talking about how, like, Ohio State paid Cincinnati not to play them or something. I mean, it was.
Is there anything else under announcements? If not, then a motion to adjourn.
Yeah.
Minnesota played North Carolina.
You're kidding, because North Carolina sucks.